Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. On the hottest day in a New York summer, one juror attempts to do the right thing in the face of opposition to defend the rights of a young man in a murder trial. 12 Angry Men move from play to film, and now we're talking about it on a podcast this week on Zach on Film.
Hey, Zach.
Hey, Steven.
So let me ask you, where did 12 Angry Men start?
In a play. On the theater.
It actually started as a TV
it went from
episode, then to stage. Then to film.
Oh, well, look at that.
Yeah, crazy.
Well, the writer for the film wrote the stage
Play. The play and also wrote the television version.
Not any.
Yeah, and interestingly, the Henry Fonda part, not the Henry Fonda part, the Martin Balsam part was played by Mr. Roper.
Yeah, see, this is the weird thing, because when this movie starts, the graphics feel like you're watching a television show.
Yeah.
Because it just kind of flashes up and it's like, oh, I'm watching CBS. And then I start thinking.
Westinghouse Studio
One. And then I kept going, I'm pretty sure I've seen this on television. Not, you know, yes, I've seen the movie on television, but I'm pretty sure I've seen some different people playing these parts. Mm. And then you go back and read and said, oh, first it was TV, then a very successful play, and then the movie. And these were all within like three years of each other.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of crazy when you think about
it. That's really tight time span.
Which also brings me up.
It's a really, really strong script, though.
It is, but I don't know. I'm somewhat conflicted about that because it's the exact same story.
Yeah.
It is the exact same elements. Different people playing it. We can talk about that later in the show. Right. But it's like, wow, you're regurgitating your same stuff.
But
three times.
In 1954, what percentage of the population had a TV?
Well, regardless, it's just like, I don't know. It's almost like, I don't know. It just seems very odd that in that short amount of time that you're going to take your work, which is popular, and you're going to turn it into the TV show, the stage play, and the movie. Boom, 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 boom. And there's no change to the story. Now, granted, the story is really solid, but I mean, even when we look at a comic book movie adaptation, there's drastic changes from the comic book concept to the movie concept to a television series concept. And they're all supposed to fit together or be the same story or whatever. So I don't know. This seems, for some reason, it rubs you the
wrong way.
It does for some reason, because it's like we talk about remakes a lot and why we like or don't like this idea of remakes. And this is literally saying, well, this was successful on television. How about if I take it on the road? And
yeah,
oh, how about if I take this to the movies?
But it's different than... You know, I don't know, Alien getting remade or Psycho getting remade into a new film, because you're just moving it from the same medium to different medium.
Right.
You're not just redoing 12 Angry Men as a TV program three times. You're changing the medium of the storytelling aspect. You can do things different. And granted, TV and film are pretty close, but you get the middle part, which is a play, which probably added something and influenced, and they probably tightened the script up a little bit for moving the play to the film. So I understand where you're coming from, but there is like this difference of, it's not totally a remake, it's an adaptation. It's like, we don't really complain when Jaws becomes a book,
right?
You know, it's the same story, just a different medium of storytelling. I mean,
He meant 2001, A Space Odyssey.
We'll say Steven.
Because I think that was...
Let me ask you a question. Would it help or would it change your cognitive dissonance had it started as a regional stage play, then gone to TV, then gone nationwide as a movie?
No. It's not the order in which it's done. It's the fact that Lion King is a very successful Disney animated movie.
Yes.
Lion King is a very successful Broadway musical.
Yes.
Yes.
Same general story. Two
very different,
executions on that.
But
this is not a widely deviation from that. What this feels like, and what this honestly feels like, is, why don't we round up, you know, this was so successful on television, more successful than we thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. Now it's really crazy on the stage, and people are wanting to do this. Why don't we round up some of the youngest, or not youngest, why don't we round up some of the best actors of our time and put them together in this grand movie of great actors and let them do their thing? Because that's kind of what this feels like, is almost like an Ocean's 11 or Dirty Dozen or something like that, where it's like, well, let's gather all these super well-known actors and maybe some brand new up-and-coming actors.
But a lot of them, I believe, weren't. A majority of the 12 featured are not film actors. Yeah. They just found guys in New York that were acting.
Right. Put them television in the film. Actors. Yeah. A lot of them.
Then that sparked their careers, because every single person around that table, you can go, oh, yeah, it's that guy. It's that guy. It's that guy. It's that guy.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, just, I mean, to me, that's just what it feels like. I'm not saying that this is a terrible movie. I just feel like it's.
I think Matthew had it in that. The reason why this didn't feel strange back then is because when it was on TV, not everybody had a TV. And then when it was in theater, even fewer people actually saw it on the stage, because you had to be physically there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when this became a movie, this was actually the very first like really wide distribution where everybody could go see it.
Right.
Because more people could afford to go to the movies than could afford to buy a television.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the point where if you actually look at the guys that we know in the movie adaptation, this is 57. This is pre-Twilight Zone. Most of these guys appear in the Twilight Zone as young unknown actors. I think with the exception of Henry Fonda and Ed Begley, this is kind of guys who are about to be famous guys. This is maybe not so much an Ocean's 11 as it is maybe a Dazed and Confused, where you get that nexus of talent that then breaks huge, and you know, in the early 1960s, because Klugman and Jack Warden and E.G. Marshall, all those guys, their big stuff is ahead of them. The Defenders is ahead of them. You know, Quincy's 25 years down the line.
Winnie By the way, his name is Quincy.
No, exactly. I totally agree with you guys on the reasons why. I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
I guess I just, my concern is that it just feels like, oh, hey, let's go see that new Reginald Rose thing. Oh, you mean 12 Angry Men, the thing that was on television 2 years ago? Oh, you mean 12 Angry Men, that thing that was a stage play that ran for 6 months downtown? You mean that brand new thing from Reginald Rose? That's kind of what it feels like, oddly.
How was that DC animated cartoon about All-Star Superman?
Well, but that's what he's saying, though. What he's saying is that had significant changes to it.
Yeah. Matthew, it actually did.
Because it's a half an hour thing, whereas All-Star Superman is like just to read it will take you a few hours.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's changes in those things, but it just felt like, I don't know. That's just my opinion on this. Sure. It just feels like wow, really? Okay.
I like angry 1950s film nerd Steven.
It's these kids these days. Yeah. These kids. You know the kind that I'm talking about. It's these Zacks of the world that are screwing everything
up. It's in their blood. Watching TV shows in the movie theater is in their blood.
I vote not guilty.
The end. There's your story right there.
Four angry nerds. That's what this episode should be called.
I'm not angry. I love this movie.
No, it's a really, really good movie. Don't get me wrong.
No, no.
I'm not dissing on the movie. I'm just the whole thing.
Yeah.
But did you get a feeling when you were watching this? When I did, and I knew it was a stage play before a film going into it, I was about halfway through the movie, and I decided, I don't think I would like this on stage, because the way they execute this story with this camera is, like, there's no way I would want to sit on a balcony and watch these guys act this out.
Yeah. No, this is a really, when it comes to staging cameras and actors, this is a really good example of making sure that 90% of the time you've got your screen direction correct, and that you've got your characters and players laid out. So that this works and is not confusing to the audience.
No, I finished. Actually, I was like halfway through this film, and then even after thinking about it more, once I finished it, this is one of the best controlled uses of a camera we have seen in all the movies we've watched. Like best use of a camera, and simplifying it down to one room. not be getting fancy really at all. It's all very subtle, but it's just like moving a camera so specifically. I don't think we've seen anyone use a camera as good as they did in this movie.
Yeah, no, it was really good. I question though some of the sudden close-ups of sure. faces, yeah, which sure. just was like, whoa, that is shocking.
Yeah, that's a lot of
just a little bit.
I was reading. I remember it was someone commenting on the director talking about why he did that. But through the most of the movie, I believe it's like or junior 10, the old guy or 9 yeah, or 8 or something. I remember. Yeah, yep. The old guy. And they said, usually when he speaks, he's not like beating around the bush. He's like just straight at someone,
right.
And tell him how it is. And so that's why they always like a lot of the times when you cut to him really quick, it's like full frame in the mm-hmm. face, right up in his face.
Right.
Because it matches his attitude usually when he's going at one of the other jurors.
Yeah.
It is jarring though.
Yo, super jarring. Yeah.
And it kind of, I think for me, the way that they shot this feels like I can feel the influence of a television production in the way this comes together, not necessarily in a bad way, because when I watch this, you know, I originally actually saw this on television and you know, like on some Sunday afternoon thing or something, I believe, but
with the television version
was like lost when I was a kid.
Oh, okay. Cause
so the movie version I've seen on television,
cause here's the weird thing. We're into the third act of this and I'm like, man, I know I've seen Mr. Roper do something uh-huh. in this movie. And I'm like, where the hell is he? And so Mr. I know Roper. I've seen that television version somewhere. Yeah.
And the thing about that television version to me is when I have seen it and I think CBS aired it like a couple of years ago, just in the middle of the evening, it feels like a different experience. This really to me feels like a teleplay. It feels like a long episode of like a Twilight Zone or Westinghouse Theater of the Air or some crap.
Yeah, yeah. Studio.
But when I see, when I see the television version, it actually feels like I'm watching videotape of a production of it,
yeah.
Which is totally weird, you know, and probably tells you a lot about my absorption of media.
You know, and I guess if, you know, one of the nice things about this is that there's not a lot of deviation in the story, if there's any. I mean, you've got the actors that are playing different actors, and thank goodness it's not the same actors going from their television role to the movie role. But if you were somebody to study what are the changes in the delivery method, this is a really good example of that, because you can go and look at the television example, the version, and say, well, what worked or didn't work in this, and what are people's reactions? You could sit people down and say, okay, we want you to watch this. Let me get your reactions. What are your thoughts? And then have them watch the play of that and then get their reactions and feedback on that. And then watch the movie version and just get total different reactions from that. Now you couldn't use the same test subjects, but you'd have to get a sampling and compare some values, but that would be very interesting use of the delivery medium in this example, because you've got that, you've got those things fixed. Those are not something you have to go out and create. They're fixed with the exception of the stage play version, but it's out there.
Yeah.
In fact, I thought they did a revival of that within the last decade.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I'd heard something about that.
Mm. Where do you want to take us this week, Zach?
Let's talk about, well, just the theme of the movie I thought was interesting. Or how they conveyed the sense of many against one. There are a lot of camera shots early on in the film where Henry Fonda's character, and then the image that always sticks out in my mind is when the old man flips to his side,
mm-hmm.
and they're forcing him to start giving his opinions on why he should be voting not guilty, mm-hmm. and like many of the movies we see in the 1950s and this kind of time period, we're talking about really long focus length. We're not getting really shallow depths of field, so we're not like really isolating our characters in the foreground from the background. And they use that really well in this film to give the sense of there's a lot of people coming down on top of you.
Yeah.
There's a shot, it's like a eye level shot straight across the camera or table of juror old man. and then you get like 10 guys, his face is just like straight up all up in his face.
Mm-hmm.
You know there's distance there, but he's using that long focal lens to start compacting the room down. He does through the, through mm-hmm. the entirety of the film, and how they convey everyone going against someone, or on the opposite end, one of the more I felt the impactful scenes of the film is when old curmudgeon guy goes off on his crazy, like 3 minute long racist rant against the kid.
Yeah.
And all the jurors eventually, well, maybe like two or three, get up and turn their backs on the table, leaving him there just to rant by himself. Mm-hmm. And that we start pulling into like a really wide angle lens where mm-hmm. he creates a lot of space in the room where we've actually been collapsing on the entire film. But like everyone is, signifying they are distancing from himself, and they show that through the lens of the camera.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of stuff like that. Early on, you get a lot of two and three shots yes. of the descent of the guilty
right.
Voting jurors, and tight shots of Henry Fonda yeah. as things start changing. For example, when the old man flips, you start seeing a lot more two shots of mm-hmm. two of them, even if only one of them is speaking or only one of them being addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing right about the middle where it starts to rain, the fan starts working again. You all of a sudden start getting a lot wider shots showing mm-hmm. that kind of everybody's relaxing, everybody's taking some time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the camera, like just framing, just like the cinematography here, does triple duty
yeah.
in basically telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
So much of the story is told through cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
The director of the film, Sidney Lumet, sure. He talked about like this visual nature of he starts the camera up top mm-hmm. for right. the film, and he starts lowering it, mm-hmm. and bringing it back down, looking up throughout the film. And he said, if you want to read more about it, he talks about it in the book Making Movies.
Yeah.
That's
a good book if you haven't read
it. I have not read it. Okay. So I'll probably go search that out.
Yeah, yeah. It's
good. Yeah.
Yeah.
It may be available on Amazon.com.
Probably.
Might be.
And if you're
going to
get it from Amazon.com, you'll want to use that
click on
link over at majorspoilers.com.
I also recommend clicking on that link and picking up a copy of Network, which is also a Sidney Lumet joint, and an amazing, very emotionally similar film to this.
They actually have a Kindle version, Zach,
of Making
Movies, so you can go grab that. It's only $10.79. If you use that link at majorspoilers.com, it's not going to cost you anything extra. A little bit does come back our way, though, so
totally, every little totally, bit helps. Totally.
Do you think Henry Fonda comes off as a smug jerk at any point?
In a modern perspective, perhaps. Because, I mean, if you look at this, this is 1950s.
Yeah.
This is post, big Red Scare. This is a point where things are kind of supposed to be normalizing and what people believe is going to be a whole new broad world. And I think that there's still the expectation that Henry Fonda, as a strong, principled guy, having these strong opinions and making sure that he tells people about them so that he can say, look, you have to look at this because it's the only right thing to do. I think in 1957 has a lot of different context than it does in 2014. I would say that, yes, especially when he starts goading juror number three into screaming that he'll kill him.
Right.
And when he goes out and introduces, he breaks the law by doing his own research and buying the switchblade and introducing evidence that isn't part of the case and doing all the things that would probably make this an illegal trial. But mm-hmm. yeah, but he's also the hero. And it's kind of like, when we saw in The Searcher, sometimes you have a designated hero and sometimes you have a designated hero who isn't all hero. I think this is one where he was, in 1957, a lot quieter, stater, kind of everybody's, dad, Red Foreman presence in a way. Whereas now it kind of plays as, I'm a little bit of a dickhead.
Well, so. I asked that question is because, and this is very interesting, but in the process of trying to get people to change their minds, mm-hmm. he doesn't just say, Well, here are some facts that I found out. I went out and I bought this knife. It's the same kind of knife that this other person has. You know, in the middle of the night, you're not going to put on your glasses, da, 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 da. And he goes, and instead of just giving you all these facts, he does have to goad other people.
He manipulates them into his.
Kind of.
Well, here's the thing, though. That's lampshaded.
Right.
The guy who wants to get to the baseball game. It's a baseball game, right?
Yeah.
He points that out. He's like, do you know what the soft sell is? And he's like, no, I don't.
Yeah.
He's like, because you're doing it really well.
Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, he does kind of slowly, gently kind of nudge everyone. And anytime somebody comes at him, he kind of kung fu's them into like basically into showing that their position is wrong.
Right, right, right.
Right. And, you know, the irony of it all is if you really take the assumptions that they're making at the beginning of the movie and the assumptions that they're making at the end of the movie, both positions are really kind of equally soft, and they don't really have a whole lot of evidence one way or the other.
Well, but that's the I think that's the whole point of this you're not trying they're not Henry Fonda, I don't think, comes in to prove the boy's innocence. That's not what he's trying to do. He's just trying to point out that in our court system, if there's a reasonable doubt, you can't convict somebody, especially when it means someone's death, that someone's going to be put to death because of this. And I think what he does, and he does an excellent job, and it's very well written in the way of let us introduce slowly reasonable doubt. And the thing that I think seems at times very ham-fisted is his method in which he's trying to convince each of the jurors in that way. I think is the thing that I kind of have it's the greatest thing. And it's the worst thing about this movie to me is that he's introducing the reasonable doubt. And one by one, people are like, oh, you see the light bulb. And this is also goes into the good acting by everybody around the table is that one by one, you literally see Jack Klugman's face go, wait a minute. He's right. This is not how you would hold a knife. Oh, reasonable doubt. Changing my vote, you know, and I think I think that's really powerful acting in there. But I don't know. There are times in where Henry Fonda's character is just like, "Yes, I am the greatest, aren't I?"
Well, and the real punch in the gut for me comes when he finally breaks E.G. Marshall, where he's like the eyeglasses discussion, and you see E.G. Marshall turning this over in his head and making the rational decision. And not only does he turn, he takes two other guys with him. That's an incredible moment because you see him thinking it out. And then you see the other guy go, wait, if he changed his mind,
and
you know, it's just a beautiful set of dominoes. And the acting is just so subdued. I love it.
The characters and like the characters are so well written and occupy such a specific space, but also such a distinct space. They rarely bleed into each other. You kind of have two loud mouths, for example. But they're two very different types of loud mouth, right?
Right.
And the E.G. Marshall character, like as I was watching it and going through it, like that's probably my favorite character in the whole thing, because he goes in and he's like, okay, here are the facts. Blam, 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 blam. He's guilty. And the moment that the facts turn, you don't, he's not like, a lot of the other people who then starts like backtracking and defending themselves. He's like, nope.
Facts change.
Yep. The facts have changed.
Yeah. Some of the people, we know what their occupations are. And we learned that Henry Fonda is an architect and those kinds of things. Jack Klugman, I forget what his job was. We know one of them is
a paramedic.
We know one of them is an ad sales.
Yeah.
We know one of them is a,
That's 12. Robert Weber.
He's great. I love him.
Yeah, he does such a great job.
Yeah.
Wouldn't he have been a great Superman?
He would have. Yeah. I really think so.
E.G. Marshall is a stockbroker.
Do they say that?
Yes.
Okay, because to me, he's very analytic and almost like an accountant, which a stockbroker would have that business background to where you just present him the facts, and the minute that logic chain changes, guilty, yes or no. Oh.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Yeah. Like, to him, it is a logic problem.
Yeah.
And the moment the answer changes, like, he has no problem, no emotional compunction to be like, nope, I'm on the other side now. And then everybody's all right.
What I really find most fascinating, though, are the quiet interactions that really show how strong these characters are. To the point where the gentleman with the accent, "I beg your pardon." The other guy's like, "What are you so polite about?" And he's like, "It's the way I was brought up, just as you were not."
Yeah.
I love just the interactions between these. We don't even know their names, but they're so incredibly well drawn within the space we're given.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really crazy how we get, you know, 3-hour movies with a handful of characters where you see like very little character growth. Mm-hmm. But in this movie, which is actually relatively short, all mm-hmm. things considered,
hour and a half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is so much growth just from, like, for example, juror number 2, John Fielder, mm-hmm. AKA Piglet.
Right.
Red Jack.
Right. Who goes, like, he gets bullied earlier, pushed around, and by mm-hmm. the end, he's really standing his ground. He's mm-hmm. really, you know, telling people to shut up and getting people off his back. You know, that's like, and it never feels forced. You're not like, why is this guy brave all of a sudden, right? Mm-hmm. You see that growth. You see him back the old man. You see him see the other characters and what they're doing, and he comes around in a different way, not just for his vote. Because it would have been easier to bully him for his vote, but he actually kind of like comes around of his own volition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I like all of the character development. I like all of that. I think it brings up you know, lots of questions about age and how we mm-hmm. perceive sure. age,
yeah.
how we mm-hmm. perceive class. Not so much race, because the kids we see him, and
yeah,
he's,
it's interesting.
There's an element in there though.
It's interesting, I mean, because I think there's a real like expectation that this kid's Italian.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And Jack Klugman, who I don't know if he's Italian,
right?
But he looks Italian, yeah. You know, and that's important.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the biggest thing that is the thing that as you two mm-hmm. get older,
yeah,
you might start getting into the same thing that maybe Matthew and I kind of run into sometimes of, man, you kids these days.
Sure.
What's wrong with you kids these days? Mm-hmm. I can't wait till you are our age and you can have some heights. But, you know, that whole issue of, well, just because he's young
right.
and different mm-hmm. and he's using some slang that is not something that I would use, or he dresses a certain way that's different from what I would, there must be something wrong sure. with that kid. And so I know in my heart that he killed that person.
Right.
It's
right.
just... It's really kind of if people haven't been on both sides of that fence, and I think yeah. you have to be older to be on both sides of that fence.
Sure.
It really is eye opening to say, wow, you're right. You know, when I was, you know, 20 years old, I would have said, oh, all those guys are nut jobs. How would yeah. you ever how right. would that ever be believable? And now when I'm their age or older, I'm like, ah, I've been in that situation. I know yes. where they're coming from, and yeah, it's still crazy wrong in many cases. Mm-hmm. It's really weird. I don't know. For me, it was very, very weird to kind of see that from both sides of yeah. of the fence and understand where that ageism mm-hmm. is coming sure. into yeah. play. And even from the old guy, because the old guy's like, oh, yeah, you know, an old person who doesn't get any notice or anything, he may remember things differently because he wants the yeah. attention and da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. And he makes some really good points that sure. I'm sure whenever mm-hmm. I'm 75, I'll that's sit right. there and go, I sure wish someone would pay attention to me.
Yep.
Greetings, listeners. This is the very, very old comics podcast.
Nerds on AARP.
Yeah. Hey, how are you?
I mean, do you get that same thing, Matthew, or not?
Oh, God, yes. When I first saw this, and I've seen this movie dozens of
times. I saw it when I was probably, I think in high school I saw it at least once, or at least parts of it once.
I know I was 17 when I first saw it because I was totally in love with my English teacher. And she was the one who showed it, and this is why I was all about this movie. But when I first saw it at 17, I was like, oh, these guys, you know, they felt like caricatures, with the exception of a couple. I mean, Piglet does really well. I feel like E.G. Marshall, even then, I was like, yeah, I know that officious kind of mm-hmm. no-nonsense guy. And I know Henry Fonda is Henry Fonda. But now I look at this and – while I'm not quite to the point where I think maybe I'm the old guy looking in on the young guys arguing, I can definitely see, you can feel that point of, you know, being Martin Balsam Have I told you my story about 12 angry men and trying to get me out of jury duty? I go on jury duty. They're interviewing me and they're like, well, how do you think you would deal if you thought one thing and the rest of the group thought others? And I said, being me had to be, you know, I didn't intend to make a reference, but I couldn't not. And I said, well, you know, I don't necessarily want to be Henry Fonda in 12 Angry Men, but I think I could stand my ground. And I thought, first of all, it's a reference. They're going to think I'm flippant and stupid, and they're going to chuck me from this jury so I can go and, you know, read comics and get back to what I'm doing. No. Not only was I on the jury, I was the foreman of the freaking jury.
Nice.
Because I think I referenced Henry Fonda standing up to everyone in 12 Angry Men. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of those moments where, yeah, I definitely felt the Henry Fonda because we were in the thing and somebody said, well, what about this? And I said, well, that's relating specifically to an emotional state that we can't prove or disprove and we don't want to bring our thing into it. And then, you know, of course, I had to buy a switchblade.
Yeah,
it was all long and involved.
So what do you think? I watched this movie with Aubrey.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
we did.
I'm surprised.
So we'll get to that.
Okay.
Based on our discussion, and a question she posed to me.
Okay.
The question is, what is 12 Angry Men, or what is the point of 12 Angry Men? Like, what
that
is
was the question I was just going to ask you?
Okay, because. You know, Aubrey and I are watching it. She seems engaged. She asks a question about some characters, blah, 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 blah. Get to the movie. I'm like, so how was that movie? You know, that was pretty freaking good. She goes, yeah, I didn't really care for it. What are you talking? We were like talking about it and the thing. And she's like, I just don't know what the point was. It's like, what do you mean? Like, and then that was like, why does there have to be a point to the movie?
So what is the point? I mean, what is the point? What did you get? Because there's a lot of ways you can look at this. You know, as I said, yeah. You could look at it from an ageism
sure.
perspective. You could look at it from a bigotry perspective. You could look at it from so many different ways.
Yeah. When I thought about it a little more, it was more like this broad sense of this is a story of a guy just standing up
yep.
for something.
Sure.
I mean, and then there's a lot of facets that go into that of racism, ageism, and... The sexism never gets in there because there's no females in the movie.
That's right. This movie certainly doesn't pass the Bechdel test.
No, this is certainly a sausage fest. the idea of like what is the point of this movie? I thought about it, and like what's the point of any movie besides like sure. entertainment value? Like, does every movie have to have a point?
Well,
does it make it a good movie if there is one or not?
Well,
if
but
it's
I think
not?
There's. I mean, you. As a creator, have a goal in something.
Sure.
Okay. I want people to pick up the phone and switch their cable provider. I want people to find some amusement or find some connection with the characters or come to this realization, or I want to present a thesis and then defend my thesis in my film. And so anytime you create anything, you have a goal in mind, a purpose in mind. You know, Zach on Film wasn't created just so we could talk about old movies. It was created so we could educate you.
So you could stop being like, Zach, you see this? You're like, no, you're like, damn it, Zach.
Yeah, it's like
that was the whole point of this podcast.
Really, the secret point of Zach on Film is that we like you and we wanted to talk to you about stuff that we like, but we couldn't because you didn't have the basis.
Right.
So
right.
we made a whole podcast about it.
Yeah, we want you to like us more.
Yeah.
By forcing you to watch old movies.
That's right.
You know, any time when you create something, you need to have a point. And if you don't have a goal, if you don't have an objective, then you are creating nothing.
I think interestingly, 12 Angry Men isn't making a political statement,
no,
but because of its wrapping, because of its setting and everything that happens in it, it seems like it should. So
right.
you watch the movie and really it's like the plot of the movie is 11 guys are convinced of something, one guy isn't, eventually convinces them that they are not either. Like,
right.
that's what happens in the movie. That's the plot of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, well, was that like a big thing about reasonable doubt?
No,
is it reasonable doubt? Is like, No, it's really not about reasonable doubt. It is like, it's very much a character story about one guy who believes something, a bunch of guys who kind of jumped to a conclusion, and then everybody kind of, like, basically one guy convinces everyone else. Like, I think that's the point of 12 Angry Men.
The whole thing is, and it's really great if you wanted to use this from a learning standpoint, it's about how do you build consensus and what are the arguments that you can use to sway people from one side. And there are some people like the preacher person, the old man, who you don't have to go very far to get him to come into your camp.
Sure.
But then there's other people that you have to go a long, long, long ways to convince them of your ideas and to build consensus around that idea.
And that's a great way to look at 12 Angry Men, because it's like, it, in a way, in a very interesting way, this is a movie that actually kind of teaches you how to argue.
Yes.
When you meet somebody who is logical, if you appeal to their heart, they're going to be like, well, that doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah.
So you have to argue with them through logic. If you meet someone who's emotional, you appeal to them through their heart. If you meet someone who is concerned about money, you appeal to them economically.
Right.
If you meet someone who's very social, then first you convince everyone else, and then when you say, hey, it's a party over here, and they're like, oh, yeah, I believe whatever you say.
You know, that guy, he changes his mind. He's super indifferent the entire time. He just wants to get out and go to the baseball game.
Sure.
And when it rains and it's clear that that game's going to be rained out or at least delayed, he's like, yeah, whatever. I can hang out for another hour. It's not going to be a big deal.
A great moment. A great moment in the movie is like, he's like, okay, not guilty. Whatever gets us out of here. And then one of the guys who is like the old guy who has voted not guilty already, he's like, no.
Yeah.
I think it's the,
immigrant guy.
Yeah.
He's like, no. No, you don't.
Yeah. You don't get that choice. So I think that's kind of what it is let's examine how we make an argument and convince people to our point in a very interesting way. And you're right, through character development, through interesting characters, through interactions. I think it's really a great example of that. So a couple of things. First thing is, what is it, Matthew? We watched this, I think, in the persuasion class. And it was called On the Road to
Purgatory.
No, not El Dorado. But it was these four people, and they decided, and it was set in like the 1920s or something, and they decided they wanted to go get ice cream. And this took place in Texas. God, I forget what the name of the movie was. But they end up going to this ice cream place, and they have a terrible time. And through the process of this film, you realize that nobody ever really said, let's all go get ice cream. It started out by one person saying, oh, it should be nice if we got ice cream. And then somebody else kind of, everybody miscommunicating with one another. And so they all ended up on this road going to a place where they didn't want to get to. So there are some films that you can look at it from that point of view and say, wow, that is a way to examine technique and appreciate things. This is not a film that is a critique of the judicial system.
No,
it's not a critique.
I would say if anything, this movie kind of lauds the judicial system.
Yeah.
I think it misrepresents
Yes.
But certainly, it's 1957, you know.
Well, and of course we don't know what, I mean, I still think today jury deliberation is sealed, so we don't know what goes on inside the jury room unless people are talking about it.
Yeah.
So this is not a film that's trying to change anyone's views on the judicial system. Unlike there was an episode of The Rockford Files where Jim Rockford gets called before a grand jury and they're just asking him questions. And he's like, I have no idea what this is in reference to. You can't tell me what case it's involving. And so he can't answer questions, and they find him in contempt of court and they throw him in prison where he gets severely injured and beat up. That was an episode that really took a look at what's wrong with the grand jury system and was an episode that was instrumental in changing the way the grand jury system worked. That's not what this film is.
No.
What else you got for us, Zach?
I got something real quick. Sure, are we going to talk about the serious elephant in the room? That is that this movie was remade as Jury Duty with Pauly Shore.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes, it was. And
you're
actually,
a terrible human being for mentioning it.
Here's the thing.
I've seen this story has been told. We talked in the Wonder Woman episode of Major Spoilers this week. We talked about it, or Matthew talked about how he's seen this story told a million different times. we have seen since 1957 this story told on Three's Company in a bunch of different ways. So it doesn't surprise me here.
Here's the great thing about, like, here's actually the genuinely great thing about Jury Duty. If you take 12 Angry Men and then you look at Jury Duty, it's amazing that it's the same movie except the main character's intentions are not pure. Mm. You know, in this one, the main juror, or the juror that we, Fonda, he kind of is like, oh, I have a reasonable doubt in my mind. I just don't think that we should throw somebody, you know, throw a noose around somebody's neck just because we want to get out of here. Sure, but like the Pauly Shore character, they get sequestered because they're taking so long to deliberate. So he gets a hotel, he gets room service. He's like either homeless or just like unemployed or whatever. So he starts stretching out the deliberations and basically arguing for this open and shut murder case to get them to stay, which is actually, I thought, a really smart take on it. Now, the movie's pretty dumb. But it's like, if you're going to take something like that, changing that, that as that idea of the main character actually serves to give you a different movie experience.
But it does one thing differently.
Go ahead.
Pauly Shore, Tommy, is the foreman of the jury. He's actually in charge of the jury. And I think that that again, is it supports your point more than anything. They remade this movie, but they made changes to make that character not only less, you know, more of a kind of a selfish character, but they put him more in a seat of power.
Well, which actually, I think, weirdly comes back and gives us an interesting point. I thought that the weakest character by far in the movie is the foreman. You get very little from him as to why he decides things, changes his mind or something. So weirdly,
he doesn't even tell us why he changes his mind.
He just does. And interestingly, again, when you look at like a parody, it's like, you know what? It does make sense to roll the Luke Skywalker character and Han Solo character into one and make him Prince Lone Star. In the same way, it makes sense to take that dissenting juror and making the foreman, because the foreman actually isn't advancing the plot. He's basically a plot device, kind of ticking clock kind of thing.
Right. He's the one that has to keep the deliberations going.
Right.
He's the one that has to run the vote, those kinds of things. But I mean, you're right. I agree with you there.
So, you know, analyzing a parody or something, or like a comedic take on something, can actually bring you insight into the original work.
Definitely. Because one of the great things about parody is you have to understand the source material to understand what makes it so dang funny. And you're right. If you have to go back and understand 12 Angry Men in order to do jury deeper duty. Meaning from Jury Duty, then that's all for it. So the film that I'm thinking of, and it's The Conundrum, and this was a more like an educational film, it's The Abilene Paradox, for those people that are wanting to know what I'm referring to.
I remember that.
Yeah, that's but it's about a breakdown in group communication.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like a sequel to The Andromeda Strain.
Yeah, The Abilene Paradox. Because
I've been to Abilene, but I think that's already a scary place.
But I think the movie that it was terrifying. Made was called The Road to Abilene. And the first time I saw it, I was like, Abilene, Kansas? Oh, okay. Yeah. And then I was like, what the hell are they doing in Texas? So... but yeah, so some people who have already fired up their comment section, this happens a lot. I understand that people send me a Twitter and then 5 minutes later, they're like, oh, never mind. Heard you talk about
this. Making the transition from play to film, there was one really weird part in 12 Angry Men where it was clear that it was either like a scene break or like we're transitioning into the third act. Is they're all standing around the table.
And it starts raining.
And they're like, okay, now, like, we'll pause with the rain, and now the light's kind of dimmed in the background, and now we'll all just, like, scanter off to our seats, because it's like they all just stopped, and they stood there for, I swear, like, 5 seconds, and then they started, and they moved.
So,
so weird.
If you wanted to, that's why I think, too, maybe you were thinking more of the play, because there is a definite act one, act two break. The other thing is... and you'd have to really track down the original broadcast schedule of 12 Angry Men. I'm going to bet Studio One ran this as 2 one-hour sessions with a long commercial break in between, so that you hit the end of your first act, you went to your commercial break, and came back as the thunderstorm had started. that was the other thing that I thought about. But you're definitely right from the film standpoint of, and like, yeah, there's an act break here.
Yeah, and not only that, but like it gets dark. So it's like, I think in both the teleplay and the play, time is supposed to have passed, but in the movie, it just like it rains and then like it's dark really quick. It's like, can you believe it got that dark that quick? Yeah, like, and I think like that, I wouldn't be surprised if that line was thrown into the movie. Again, to lampshade this thing, was like, it's supposed to be later now, but we can't do that because of how we've set this up.
Well, but I mean, it's summertime, it's still light out at 7 o'clock, because they do make a note to, it's 5 o'clock now, let's talk till six, and then let's go till seven. There's still time for people to get, but even in the summertime, it's going to be sunny at 7 o'clock at night. But no, it's an interesting change of pace. I don't remember if at the end of that break, or when that break occurs, is the jury divided 6-6 at that point?
I don't think so.
No, I think they're 8-4.
Yeah. Okay.
There's like, I remember thinking like, if there was a half and half moment, it's fast.
It's really fast.
I don't think it is. I think what it is like, there's this huge turn where like three of them go over to not guilty. And all of a sudden there's only basically three guys left over who are still saying guilty.
Well, let's see. We start with juror 8, and then juror 9 changes his mind. Then
there is a point when they're equally divided, and you're right. It's probably very, very short. And I think that's when baseball guy is basically, whatever.
It's at 6-6 at the rainstorm, because that's when Red Jack decides to vote not guilty, and he's the sixth guy.
Okay.
And then the rain comes in, and then the guy starts whining about his baseball game getting canceled. And I think that's when he actually starts paying attention to the case.
Yeah.
Is when he doesn't have to worry about missing his game. So, yeah, I think you're right. And then there's the big swing of like three guys when they convince juror 4.
Yep.
Well, yeah, right at the end. I mean, right, where were you last night? As soon as the bigotry comes out and the bigot is shunned by the group, the rest of them come along very quickly. That toppling point to get to, I'm angry at my son.
Right.
He popped me in the face because I was too hard on him. Just comes up very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Well, and Jack Warden, literally, I think he comes out and says he just changes his vote to get it over with.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. If we're looking at his character, it seems like the reason he is voting guilty, obviously, is because of his emotional issues that he has with his son, who left him, and they got into a fight. And he knows that kids these days, if my son will pop me in the face and go on a fight, then it's for sure that this kid is going to stab his dad. Well,
and forget, it's like he hasn't thought about it that much.
Yeah.
He just sees this ungrateful kid.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's it for him. It's like, he has to be guilty, right? And just like the other guy just sees this underprivileged person and is like, oh, yeah, obviously he did it. I mean, it's in his blood, right?
Yeah, they're raised in that stuff.
People are born poor.
Right. So as soon as those two fall, I mean, it's like, I think everybody else, I don't want to say everybody else is easily swayed, but ad exec, he gets convinced pretty easily.
He holds out for a while because he's also kind of not involved.
Right.
Yeah. He's like, nope, you guys are crazy. And he's like, all right, I can see it. And then he gets yelled at and he's like, all right, back to guilty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. He actually, doesn't he change back and forth?
He does.
Yep.
Twice. He goes from guilty, not guilty, guilty, and then back to not guilty again.
And then there is that, the thing that I really enjoy is when Jack Warden, when 7 changes his vote, the old man who is on the side that he has changed to still gives him hell for not following the process and not being patriotic and wasting his vote. And he finally has to admit that, no, he actually really believes it, which I thought was kind of cool, too. I mean, it's that weird, complex moment in the middle of it where you'd think that if he switches over to the side that you're on, you wouldn't question him about it, which I really, I liked that moment.
What's that? Oh, yeah. Yep, good moment.
So, Zach, what are you taking away from this?
Taking away from this, talk about a film to forget Clerks. Like, this movie should inspire you to make a low budget movie.
Oh, yeah.
This is one set, it's one room, essentially.
Yep.
like 90 minutes of the 94 minutes take place within one room. You don't even have to get very fancy in your lights. Just get some guys and a good script and you can knock out something. Low budget. Learn how to move a camera. Watch this movie. Learn how to move a camera then close spaces and
really make relations. Staging your camera.
Yeah.
And is really important. There's a book that I've told you to read. It was, I think, in your super advanced class, called Cinematic Motion. And the other one is Cinematic. It's by the same guy. And there's two books. They complement one another. One is an introduction to staging actors in front of the camera. And then the other book is, okay, now that you've got that down and you've known the formula of how to do this, now here's how we move the camera within that scene. It's really a good combo of learning staging your cameras and your actors. So I would recommend that. But yes, this movie is really excellent at trying to do that and keeping all eye directions and everything down. And I would love to see the camera plot this movie, because you know it's got to be super detailed so that when they're talking about this scene, you don't accidentally have somebody's eye on the wrong side of the screen.
And the blocking for this whole thing had to be really extensive. And the camera has to be basically someone else you're blocking, right? One thing I think, if you want to spend some time thinking about this movie, which you should because it's a cool movie, a big part of this is the times and the time when it was done. And you have, by most definitions, 12 white dudes doing this movie. If you were to adapt this movie, who do you make black? Who do you make a woman?
Well, the Jack Klugman character, I think, would probably be the easiest one to put into a, you know, a black role,
a minority
role of any kind, really. And because it's like the Italian guy you could replace with, or I should say the Italian guy, the immigrant guy you can replace with someone who's Hispanic as a naturalized citizen. You could, but the Jack Klugman one is one that really would typify the race side of it.
I would like juror number 4 to be a woman.
Which one is that one?
E.G. Marshall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The rational guy who will not back down. I think that would be a great role.
I think Piglet would be a good one too.
Sure.
Because then that's the thing is like
you wouldn't be necessarily tied to only having one of each.
Right.
But you could seriously alter the way that things play out if, for example, you show that the kid is black,
right?
The Klugman character is black, and the Peter Fonda character is black. Like all of a sudden,
Sidney Poitier is Henry Fonda.
All of a sudden, it's a race thing, right? If that character remains white, then it's not.
So let me ask
you: if that character is a woman, then it's like, is that compassion because she's a lady, and ladies tend to be more like?
But so
there are so many things that go with that.
So, but let me ask you this. In the context of what we talked about before, with this movie being an examination of techniques to develop consensus, the minute that you add in these other types, that blurs that line of saying, hey, here's the technique of consensus to, oh, this movie is about racism or this movie is about gender equality or anything like that.
Well, but
would that, do you think that would hurt? Because
I don't think it would, because we already have the obscuring factors of this movie being about fathers and sons, this movie being about economic problems. So no, I think it would. I think if your goal was to show this movie, like this movie is, how do you build consensus on a group? Then throwing a different mix of people might cloud that.
Yeah.
But also might enrich it in a way to see same lines, just cast a woman in any one of these roles, exact same lines, the whole thing's going to change. The reaction, like, it's again, like, I find the script, say, this character is now a woman, any random one, and like, as you're reading it, I bet you the first time she gets dismissed, the first thing you think about is he's dismissing her because she's a lady, even though that's not actually in the play.
Right.
We bring so much to these things.
Right. Here's something that would be interesting. What if juror number 1, the foreman, juror number 3, the loudmouth, juror number 6, the ad executive, juror number four, the smart guy, and the polite immigrant are all female characters. That way you have characters on both sides of things arguing in and out, and then you have to constantly, anytime you have an argument, you'll have...
Well, so you're talking about it's nullifying.
Essentially, yeah, effect. you have six men and six women, but anytime you have a conflict, you'll have
an equal
at least one person on each side of each gender.
But interestingly, then you're going in to nullify that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a decision that you're making. You're saying, I'm going to add women to this play, but I'm going to work extra hard to not make it about gender.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which make sure that just like a random smattering would totally make it about gender.
And that's why I'm saying is what Matthew just said, equal.
Mm-hmm.
That's why everybody is white here.
Yep.
Because it's...
No, it's white because it's a 1957.
But, I mean, if you think about it, if you're trying to convey the message of don't focus on anything else but the persuasive ways that Henry Fonda is changing each member around the table,
mm-hmm.
it shouldn't matter.
But that is just Fonda's method of conveying that everyone else's brings them their own stuff into the and
oh
uses
yeah
their
I
own
that
stuff
episode
to convince...
of the Brady Bunch that and pulled a lot of these.
Here's something else that you have to realize is you can't make this movie today with 12 white men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. You can't do that anymore. But I think that to say that, we get into that really weird area of the expectation that, quote unquote, you only have normalcy when you have parody and everyone being the same. If you did this with an all black cast or an all Hispanic cast, I don't think that it would necessarily be a different movie. But I think if you did it with a cast that was, all over the place,
I think it would. I think it would be a very different.
I think it might even be a better movie because it would add that subtext. It would add, as you as a viewer would then be forced to confront, well, why is this happening? Why do I think this is happening for this reason? I think if they were to remake this movie today, you would have to diversify the cast in wild and bizarre ways. And I think it would be interesting to find 12 strong actors and actresses, people you know can handle it all, just throw them a script
Sandra
and here
Bullock
you are.
As Henry Fonda, George Clooney as ad exec guy, juror 12.
Sure.
12.
You get in a, you could put an Anna Faris in as juror 2.
Patrick Stewart as the old guy.
Patrick Stewart as the old guy. You get, the frick was his name?
I would like to see Jenny Slate as Baseball Tickets Man.
Yeah.
Good, yeah. Mm-hmm. You get Eddie Izzard as your European immigrant.
Sure. I think the European immigrant, like, to make that a change, I think he should be like the biggest blondest guy. I think you actually get Chris Hemsworth to play
the immigrant. John Cho.
I think Sidney Poitier would still be really good as one of these roles.
Sure.
I mean, Sidney Poitier. Well, he's dead.
Well,
but
yeah,
you can also like if you wanted like. Lawrence, I don't know if you've seen movies where Lawrence Fishburne doesn't play Morpheus.
Yeah.
But when he doesn't, like, he's on Blackish right now. I think he literally wears that same hat as the tickets guy.
Yeah.
I think he would also be great in that role as the guy who just wants to get out of there. I don't know if you guys ever saw, I think it's called SWAT. Not a good movie.
Yeah, I saw that.
But he plays a not quote unquote Lawrence Fishburne character in that.
Yeah.
And he actually does a really great job.
I think Bernie Mac would have been really good for that
role. He would have been too. Yeah. That's when you first said that, the first one is like, oh, Bernie Mac's got to be in this one. And then it's like, no, he's dead.
Yeah.
And I forgot Sidney Poitier died.
Yeah. Pam Grier could play juror number 9. That would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much like, but again, it's like.
Who would you put as the.
I think there's two ways of doing it. There's the safest way possible, which is. The Peter Fonda character is
Henry.
Black. The low income guy that gets he's played by
Jack Klugman.
He's Hispanic.
Juror number 5.
And Piglet's a girl. Like that way, all of the roles are okay. You have a black person. He's the one in the right. It's fine. He is able then to intimate a racial issue, but the Peter Fonda character never necessarily openly says he was a racist. Right. Mm-hmm. So right. he gets to.
So is the kid then black or does it matter?
I think he wouldn't have to be. But again, to play it safe, he could be.
But he would have if you're going off the Klugman character, then the kid would have to be
He could
Hispanic.
Be Hispanic, which then, again, would separate the Fonda character from that.
Right.
Like, they are both minorities,
right.
but there's no not necessarily like, oh, I'm, you know, not necessarily that kinship as somebody from your own race or minority group.
Mm-hmm. One of the strengths of this piece is when they say they're all like that, they never tell us who they are.
Right. Absolutely. Well, that's
we may not even know the kids. I mean,
he's talking about is not it's not a racial thing at that point. They're talking about a socio-economic position. He's talking about a class position that it's these lower poor people.
But actually, we don't know that. That could all be rolled up because if you live in New York, then those people, those poor people who happen to not be black, are probably either Irish or Italian or Jewish. So that can all be conflated into one thing or not. But I think that racial component could very well be there. So, like, the I think that's the safest changes that you can make. From there, you can make much more unsafe changes. Like, for example,
making everyone Hispanic and Henry Fonda being Matt Damon.
Yes. Yes. That movie actually got done. It was called Elysium. And in that one, Peter Fonda gets an exoskeleton.
Yes. I think, was that on this show that we talked about that, or was that a...
I don't know, but Elysium's the worst.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, do they really expect me to believe that Matt Damon's last name would be Da Costa?
Yeah, there you go.
Matt Damon. Matt Da Costa.
Anything else that we need to get to?
Nope. I think that wraps it.
Man, we are quickly running
I think all of our votes are
line.
Now not
Yeah,
guilty.
I looked at the list again today, and... It's quickly approaching. That was it for this week when we talked about 12 Angry Men. Head over to MajorSpoilers.com and you can find the podcast posting page. Give your thoughts of how you would recast 12 Angry Men and how we talked about it this week. Have you been shopping on Amazon lately? Have you not used the Amazon the Major Spoilers link? That's a damn silly thing to do. I've done it once or twice and I beat myself up for it. But click on that link on MajorSpoilers.com, the Amazon link. It's not going to cost you any extra to shop there. But a little bit will come back to us to help keep things running here at the Major Spoilers HQ. So that's it for this week. Next week, we will be talking One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on Zach Onkel.